water was rising fast. Like, it rose like to the second level in one day. And we was on the third floor. And it was like halfway to the third floor, like by the stairs coming up. Like, it was just too much for me, like.
What's up, my name is Edward Buckles, and I am the director of this feature-length documentary, Katrina Babies. I'm a 23-year-old New Orleans native and a recent graduate of Dillard University. In May of 2015, my film, Just Another Nigga, won a jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival during the Diversity in Cannes short film showcase. In August, I will be starting up a new position as a high school teacher at Elgin Technology Academy.
Hi, my name is Lydia Nichols. I am the project manager for the documentary film Katrina Babies, and I am also a Katrina baby. I'm a 22-year-old New Orleans native, so I was 12 at the time of the storm. And I'm also, alongside the Katrina Babies film project, curating and editing an anthological text that will feature many of the emerging black scholars, writers, artists who were also in their early teens and preteens at the time of the storm.
Katrina Babies will be unlike your typical Hurricane Katrina project. In this film, I will be sitting down with young people my age and speaking with them about how the storm has impacted them physically, mentally, and even academically.
We were in a city where the media and all of its good intentions brought people home too soon.
We end up coming back down to New Orleans, and I stayed in a FEMA trailer that I later found out was filled with formaldehyde.
And I thought that was a very cool thing to do, is say, oh, New Orleans is ready for business, because you want the outside world to say, oh, New Orleans is ready for business because it's about business. But when families see that, they think it's ready to come home.
I stayed in it for 8 months. Like, 2 years later, when I would actually lay on my back, I would notice a ball sticking out of my stomach. It was a tumor that had grown because of staying in the trailer.
So what happened to our children between 2005 and 2012?
I was Officer of the Year in 2005. The guy that shot me during Hurricane Katrina was 21 years old. I had animosity toward all youth around that age. He shot on the back angle and the bullet came out through the front.
I think that we have lost and ignored a whole population of young people that haven't fit into the data sets.
When I hear Katrina Babies, I think of a very resilient, strong person or individual, a person who have seen the worst of the worst.
I feel like Hurricane Katrina was a blessing in disguise because it allowed my generation to be exposed to different cultures and bring everything that we learned back to the city.
We are currently in pre-production of Katrina Babies, and we all know that it's not cheap to make a film. So we are asking you to help us reach our goal of $25,000. With this money, we'll be feeding the crew, paying the crew, and we'll also be using it to cover travel expenses, because a lot of people were permanently displaced after Hurricane Katrina, so we want to get to those people and interview them. We'll also be using the money for things such as post-production, submitting our films into different film festivals, and also getting physical copies of Katrina Babies.
And also, a portion of those funds will be used for the publication of the anthology. The main cost associated with that will be the copyright, the graphic design of the layout, and printing an aesthetically pleasing text that you all will want to have in your libraries.
So it would be awesome if you guys could help us reach our goal of $25,000, because once again, we are Katrina babies and we want to tell those untold stories of our peers and ourselves, because it's something worth hearing. One love. Peace.
My name is Taji Mutt. I'm 10 years old and I'm a Katrina baby.
Hi. My name is Lauren Wilkes, and I am a Katrina baby.
Hi, my name is Janae Forb, and I am a Katrina baby.
My name is Dwan Jock, and I am a Katrina baby.
My name is Isaiah Buckles, and I am a Katrina baby.
My name is Damaris Kaye, and I'm a Katrina baby.
I'm Taj Graves, and I'm 10 years old, and I'm a Katrina baby.
My name is Kara Crowley.
All right, welcome back. WTL New Orleans, 91.5 FM. Gahiji here, and we are very excited, me and all my trillion cells, we're very excited to welcome Lydia Y. Nichols to the studio to talk about the documentary that we were just listening to the trailer for. It's called Katrina Babies. Welcome, independent scholar and project manager of Katrina Babies.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Oh. Hello.
Oh, there we go. The mic was on the wrong thing. Okay, you're
Whoopsies.
On now.
Oh, thank you for having me, Gahiji.
Yes.
Hello, audience, listeners in the world.
So tell us a little bit about Katrina right. Babies and how you got involved with the project.
So for several years, I've been... originally, the idea was creating like a think tank of people my age who experienced Hurricane Katrina with other friends of mine who were doing great scholarly work, primarily my friend Andrew Albert, who I went to elementary school with and is now studying philosophy at the London School of Economics, and trying to figure out how to organize that. I ended up coming to the conclusion that I would publish an anthology of work with created by creative writers, images by photographers, visual artists, etc., who shared that common experience. As I was getting that together, I reached out to filmmaker Edward Buckles, and he told me that he was working on a similar project, but the scope was a bit more expansive, the Katrina Babies Project, and he'd started reaching out to people to collect interviews. He and I met, and we talked about funding and money and all those logistical things that go into creating art. That conversation led to the realization by him that he did not want to do those things. So having a background in arts administration, project management, budgeting, timelines, all those numerical things, I offered to extend him my services. So we basically joined forces for our projects for the anthology and the film and made them joint ventures. Mm. So, yeah.
So you yourself as mm-hmm. a Katrina baby.
Yes, sir.
I was going to ask you why this is important, but you are a Katrina baby. So mm-hmm. what were you seeing that made you want to do this project before you even started talking with Edward Buckles? Did you just feel like there was a narrative that was happening around children that experienced Katrina who are now getting older and mm-hmm. perhaps acting out of this trauma or?
Yeah, definitely. I feel for myself that existing, especially as a Black female child at that time, at that intersection of Blackness and femaleness and childhood, very invisibilized, and also in the midst of that, hyper aware of the stress that the adults in my life were under. And so that being the case, like, it wasn't something I even dealt with, and I consider myself a healer. I engage in the healing arts and am around a lot of healers, but that's just trauma that I just never... that I have very recently started to work through. So, but I also, within that, I recognize myself to be sort of one of the end quote, out quote, lucky ones. Having had parents who chose to evacuate. All my family left together. My only sister who stayed, she was working at East Jefferson General Hospital in Kenner. So she was okay, and we knew where she was, and we were in contact, and we, you know, stayed with family in Texas, very, like, literally 3 days after the storm, I started going back to school. So very quickly getting back into routine, got settled, but still had not really addressed things mm-hmm. for myself. And then with my peers, even more so, because there's definitely a meta-narrative around what it means to be young, Black, and from New Orleans. And so if you fit that meta-narrative, if you're what they, if they can use your visibility or your presupposed identity to support that, then that will be used. But otherwise, you're, you know, those other aspects of you are not talked about. And if you just completely don't fit that, then you're ignored. Like, so breaking up that either or understanding of what it means to be Black and young and from New Orleans, especially in the midst of this experience that I think for a lot of us took away our innocence, especially when it or not so much innocence, but naivety, like, yeah.
What were some of the messages that maybe you're in working through your own trauma that you maybe are discovering that you were told about yourself as a young Black person from mm-hmm. New Orleans?
So when I started going to school in Texas, Texas is like George Bush like land, like well Bush land in general. They love the Bush family. So I started going to school in Texas. They had all these like portraits of the Bushes decorating the school, the office, and
that's traumatic enough right there.
Yeah, because I was very aware of how the government regarded this disaster primarily because it majorly impacted Black people. Mm. And so being 12 and aware of that, and then in this environment of people who I idolized, the man who, I mean, he wasn't single-handedly responsible, but ultimately, like, you're the chief, like, the buck is on you. So the first day alone, I met all my teachers, and the response, because I operate in this ambiguous space in relation to, like, behaviorally, not phenotypically. I appear Black. It's a thing. But they did not know. Like, they were just like, really? You're from New Orleans? And so having been displaced and then not fitting into what their idea of what who I was supposed to be, mm-hmm. Namely, you know, ignorant, academically behind, inarticulate, misbehaved, it was like, I can't even claim this space. Like, I've been removed from this space mm-hmm. against my will, and now I'm not even being allowed to claim it because to you, I don't fit into what it means. Mm. So then in a lot of ways, I tried to accentuate my Blackness or like what I understood them to think I was supposed to be. So
you started performing a little
performing,
bit.
Performing, yeah. I put on a little mask for them. Mm. A different, I mean,
you know, we're always performing.
Yeah,
certainly.
But I just switched it up that day for a year. So those days. And also going through that, like the PTSD, which I recognize it to be now, and having those like manic and depressive episodes and what comes with that in general, you know, like risky behavior, risky sexual behavior, and you're like a frisky little preteen. Yeah, so and being a Black female, and there's, you know, the hypersexualization even if you are a child, but understanding that that is a part of who you are expected to be, and having lost like that ability to identify with the space, wanting to identify with something that feels concrete or something that feels understood. And commonly those things that are understood are not true. They're not real.
So when you started performing a little bit more, when you started wearing your super colorful, shall we say, New Orleans mm-hmm. mask so that mm-hmm. people knew, was the response to you different?
Or did you
put it on so quickly that you?
Well, I think I added to the colors as the year went on. The first few weeks I was pretty tame. I mean, even the whole time really I was tame, because there's only so much a girl can do. So I was like still on the honor roll, still outperforming everyone in all of my classes.
Still humble. No,
forever humble. But I remember one time I started like skipping class. Who skips class in eighth grade? I started skipping class so I could go to all the lunches, because they had like multiple lunches, because it was like a huge school, mm-hmm. which I was not used to, because last year where I went, there were like 100 people in a class, in a like a grade level.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I wanted to go to all the lunches, so I would skip class, and I got caught, and my home economics teacher, which is home economics. But she was like, and I'm just so disappointed. I thought you were different. I thought you were a nice little girl. So that's the only direct comment that was ever made. I definitely, there's definitely a difference in the way that they regarded me from beginning to end. But... There was never any conversation around why, or like there was, I think in efforts to normalize things for a child, which I think people jumped to the conclusion that that was what needed to happen. Like, we need to stabilize things, and in efforts to do that, we're not going to talk about the destabilizing factor. At all costs. So, like, no matter what's going on and how clearly we can tell that to be a result of what happened, we're just, like, not going to talk about it, because that risks breaking down the facade.
Mm. Right. And while you were, quote-unquote, one of the lucky ones, you still, like, the lucky ones don't get all trauma-free.
Yeah,
they just don't have possibly as much hardship, which we'll I'll ask you a question about next, but what does it look like to start working through some of that trauma, that if you can go there?
Yeah. So I started sort of accidentally. One of my mentors, who's a seasoned healer, suggested that in my meditation practice I begin remembering like specific childhood events that affected me emotionally, and inserting my adult self as I am now into that memory, as like an invisible factor, but like little me would be aware of big me's presence, but no one else would.
Mm-hmm.
And like holding my hand, like walking small me through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I started chronologically with like little things when I was like 3 that I could remember and like working my way up. And eventually, it wasn't all chronological, but I eventually started thinking about the Katrina year. And what does it look like? That looks, there were a lot of tears involved, even in creating this, the, like, not even the trailer, but just, like, the press kit. Like, things that are seemingly unemotional. I just have to like stop and do a mini purge for a few minutes and then return to work. So I mean it looks like different things on different days. There were good memories and I retain those, I embrace them, and I'm not mad at Katrina or at having had that experience, but yeah, there are tears involved.
So what might it what might some of the unlucky ones, what are you tapping into those stories and experiences, what are you seeing as you kind of have made a determination that you were one of the lucky ones? What were you seeing to determine that some folks weren't so lucky?
Yeah, and okay, I just want to clarify. When I said lucky, I was being cheeky.
I know. I'm just using your language. I know that you were being cheeky. Like, nobody really that experienced Katrina at all.
Yeah,
there was no luck.
There was no luck.
There was no luck in
that. It was like, yeah.
Unless you were some kind of developer or somebody that... We know who you are.
So, in the trailer, one of the stories... that we talked about, or that was talked about, she talked about it herself, was a young woman who had this rare form of cancer from her exposure to formaldehyde after living in a FEMA trailer for 8 months, and they have no idea how to cure it. So they take the tumors out, she goes through treatment, but it's like going to be a lifelong thing because they can't cure it. So like things like that, and I mean even that, like still on the spectrum experientially before the cancer, where do you fall as far as luck? You know, like you had housing, like that's not something everybody could say. You got to come back. You know, so there, it's like this matrix of, to use Patricia Hill Collins' words, of domination, or not domination necessarily in this case, but of privilege. Because, you know, some people got to come back, some people didn't. Some people were better off where they were, but some people weren't. Some people have never come back.
Right.
Some people were multiple years behind in school and weren't able to finish, or, you know, they're just... I don't think anyone really was there's not a gradation of of privilege. It's all scattered and intersectional and things. But other stories. I have friends whose relatives were never who've never heard from relatives who stayed. They're still missing, presumed dead. I'm trying to think of some other ones.
Well, no, I was going to say, I see you tapping into all of these, you know, horrible things that have occurred to people and that they've experienced, and I don't need you to dig too deep there. I just wanted to, and there's plenty of time to talk about
Indeed.
What is happening on the streets of New Orleans and how Katrina and the babies that she made or like how there what that means and mm-hmm. what the implications are there. But let's take a quick musical interlude, mm-hmm. followed by a couple announcements. So and then we'll return with Lydia Y. Nichols talking about Katrina Babies. This public service announcement is brought to you by WTUL New Orleans. The IRS offers resources to help both individuals and businesses prepare for the disruption a hurricane can bring. Their disaster loss workbooks can help you compile a room-by-room list of personal belongings and business equipment. Those workbooks and more information are available on their website at irs.gov/publications/P584 and publications/P584B. That's a lot. You might just want to search it or something. Because I'm sure you didn't remember all that I just said there. But it's possible. I don't want to, you know, limit all of your capabilities in being able to remember URLs. If you want to keep in touch with WTUL, you can like or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We post daily social media exclusive ticket giveaways, information about upcoming shows and community events, and other bits of music news and trivia. You can find WTUL on Facebook at facebook.com/WTULNOLA and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at WTUL. We'll return in just a moment with Lydia Y. Nichols talking about the upcoming documentary film and her experience as a Katrina baby. We're back with Lydia Y. Nichols talking about the upcoming documentary, Katrina Babies. So one thing that you were, as you were talking about this young woman, I'm not sure what her name is, the one who with the tumor, mm-hmm. It just made me think about the different ways in which blackness is assaulted, constantly under mm-hmm. attack. And there was something on the, that was taped onto one of the trailers, and what it said something like, put them out.
Poison them,
and one other thing, and something I can't remember what the there I were three things, but it was like yeah. it was like a recipe for removing blackness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like yeah, displace, put them out, poison them, and so the ways in which black folks were treated after Katrina, mm-hmm. And one Katrina baby who always sticks out in my mind when I think about children mm-hmm. are there was the kid at the Superdome. And, you know, I think that the crowd was like saying help or, you know, it was one mm-hmm. of those things. And then the kids just like really earnestly like looking into the camera like, we need some help out here. And mm-hmm. I just always like remember that. It always gives me like goosebumps and like brings tears to my eyes. And mm-hmm. as I watched this, I kind of was experiencing that again and thinking about him mm-hmm. and talking to you. It also, I was like, I wonder where he's at, like mm-hmm. what his story is now. So find him for me and bring him on the show.
I'll try.
But so just the idea of the different ways in which, like, no opportunity is missed to mm-hmm. assault black bodies and black lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after going through I'm not even going to call this storm, like a powerful storm.
Mm-hmm. And then the man-made disaster.
And then the man-made thereafter. Disaster, which is exactly the assault, right? Mm-hmm. So the storm isn't the assault. The storm is just nature doing its thing. Mm-hmm. But actually, we could also put a little man-made in there if we want to talk about climate change as well. But we'll leave it as a natural event for the purposes of this discussion right now. And we'll talk about the man-made disaster of the, I don't want to call it recovery. I don't know if you have a specific way that you define it.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't even say it starts with the recovery efforts. I mean, the levee breach, like, we can all acknowledge that that was not a thing that was supposed to happen. so that in and of itself and... Mm-hmm. And then the recovery efforts gone wrong. So
I'm sorry. I didn't actually ask you a real question. I wanted to kind of talk about these different the different ways in which Black folks are assaulted and the opportunities that are not missed to assault mm-hmm. Black people, Black bodies, Black lives, Black economies. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what you've seen that assault to be? Like, I'm sure that's part of the trauma that you have is seeing the ways in which Black mm-hmm. body, I'm making an assumption there.
Yeah, that's true. That's
true. Can you talk about what that experience was like for you watching mm-hmm. Kind of Black people be disregarded and assaulted in this way?
Yeah, so background, I mentioned earlier that I went to Lusher, so going there was like this utopian idea, like we sang, you know, Feeling Groovy, we like Simon and Garfunkel in the morning all together, all the little brown and all the other colors children too. So I did not really identify with my Blackness. I knew I was Black, that was never a question, but I was not aware of oppression necessarily. So then what, like all of a sudden becoming hyper aware of it, targeted at not only just Black people because we're the majority on the earth, so that's like a very large population, but Black people, like, who, like, 100,000 Black people who share, like, a very specific identity with you. So, mm-hmm. Black, from New Orleans, from the same neighborhood, even for some of them, not all of them, but. So, watching, you know, the way that they were sort of like herded into this space, into the Superdome specifically, watching the way that they were portrayed when they were liberating goods from stores, whether they were things that they needed or not, like,
mm-hmm.
who yeah. cares, yeah. you know? But there's this whole, oh, you know, looters. And I was very aware of what that meant and what that was intended to relay to audiences about the state of things, the state of Blackness, primarily to white audiences.
What were those intentions? Speak them out.
To me, those intentions were to limit empathy for traumatized people. Mm-hmm. To justify the lack of response, or even to justify lack of response, sort of saying that we collectively were deserving of the care that we were not getting, or deserving of the lack mm-hmm. of care. Mm. And the lack of services. And to be aware of that at 12 and to know that that very easily could have been you, like, this is a very specific, like, demographic from a city that isn't even really a city. It's a very small place. Mm-hmm. 500,000 people, like not even 500,000. Yeah, it was rough. I don't know if I'm answering your question entirely.
That's okay. either way, you're saying plenty. You're saying plenty. And I appreciate, I understand what it is to kind of reach into your own trauma. And I think that that's one thing that so in the position that I'm in, a lot of people ask me to have access to members of the organization. A lot of these are formerly incarcerated people. Mm-hmm. And the ways in which I see folks being mined for their experiences, just the mm-hmm. way, like, and I started drawing this real comparison and analogy between the ways in which Black culture, Black bodies, Black people, the land, like, mm-hmm. they're mined in this way. So looking at how people who experienced, you know, Katrina, who experienced other traumas that people don't necessarily, like, attached to trauma, they just think it's some interesting story that shows this this oppression or something, mm-hmm. and not that they're mining someone's oppression, that they're mining someone's trauma.
Yeah.
So I appreciate, because I know that, you know, you're not someone that is talking about this from an outsider perspective. Mm-hmm. So I know that it's difficult. So I don't want you to feel like, oh, am I making sure to answer this question? It's just, it's important enough that you are here sharing what you're sharing with us.
Thank you.
So looking at what's happening, so the violence that's happening on the street now, mm-hmm. with especially, because most of the violence that does happen on the street, it happens with younger people. Mm-hmm. Those people, you know, I'll say, I'll just throw a little older at number. I'll say 40 and below, mm-hmm. but that's not necessarily who we're focusing on now. We're on those folks that were. Is there a specific age that you look at when you say Katrina baby, or?
I'm mostly focusing on minors, and I think even more so the 15 and younger.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't define it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, I feel like given the reality of how depression and PTSD like shapes every mm-hmm. molecule of your being.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a woman who went through that experience, every child you have will have residual PTSD from that. Like every child, like it's going to be a Katrina baby.
Mm.
And working on up from there, it's a traumatic experiences have usually, in my experience, and from my observations, tend to make folks revert to certain childhood protection mechanisms.
Mm.
So in a way, we all are. But when focusing for the film, I know what you mean. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just asking you that
answer.
As I was shaping my question, because it wasn't necessarily the question itself. The question is about what's happening on the streets now, mm-hmm. with like how the impacts and the trauma of Katrina are impacting violence in New Orleans. And also how that violence is then, what is the narrative mm-hmm. of that violence?
Yeah, that's definitely something I'm very interested in, because you know, you have things like the Charleston shooting, where the first conclusion that the media comes to is that the assailant, the murderer, the terrorist, in reality, is mentally ill. So that's like the first thing that you come to. But then you have these 22, 23, 24, 25-year-old Black men, young Black men, who 10 years ago as children were experienced this like extremely traumatic event, whether they were here or not, it was still traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were here. Some of them, you know, had to swim through those waters and saw those bodies floating and saw people die or like in whatever way. So, but there's no narrative around that. It's black men being black men. That's the way it's portrayed. It's, mm-hmm. you know, just mm-hmm. a continuation of this centuries-old meta-narrative around black savagery. And no contextualization about how the trauma of that experience needs to be assessed in restorative justice efforts. But I mean, obviously, the media isn't really concerned with restorative justice.
No, not quite. Well, I mean, I as a media person, I'm concerned with transformative justice. I want to change the way the power structures and but yeah, no, I know. I when people talk about the media, I'm certain they're not talking about me and my little operation here. So when is the film when is Katrina Babies expected to be completed?
We are hoping for planning, intending. I don't want to say hoping. That's very, yeah.
Pie in the sky.
Yeah, it's very pie in the sky, and also not particularly active. No. So we intend to have the film completed by early spring at the latest. Mm-hmm. We're going to produce a short for the anniversary. That'll be a taste of what the feature-length film will be. But in the meantime, we're actually, over the next month or so, raising the money to complete production of the film. So we have an Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign. Mm-hmm. The URL is kind of not simple. So if you go to Indiegogo, you can search Katrina Babies, and it'll come up. And then you can contribute to our efforts to produce this great documentary.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that that the money will go towards is compensating and feeding the talented and dedicated crew, mm-hmm. you know, traveling across the country to interview those that have been permanently displaced, mm-hmm. which is, you know, very important. Paying for post-production, printing DVDs, all that good stuff. So yeah. You can go to Indiegogo if you are so inclined to donate. And if you miss the audio of the trailer, you can actually watch it on the Indiegogo. So to go to Indiegogo and search for Katrina Babies if you are so inclined. And we'll put that out there at the end of the interview as well, again, to make sure that folks know. So the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary, which I've been asking people now, like, I've been thinking about the idea about how, why, what is it about 1, 5, and 10, and number 10s that mm-hmm. are so attractive? I think it's this media that does this, that mm-hmm. that use those as markers for when they're supposed to descend upon some story and revisit it or something mm-hmm. like that. So that's very much what is happening here for the Katrina 10. So, one, I just heard you're doing a short, so that's one way to kind of capitalize on the attention that mm-hmm. Katrina 10 will get, because I think that this is a very important film, not only in the Katrina narrative mm-hmm. and story, but also in the black narrative and also in the trauma narrative. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very important film. But so that's one way to kind of capitalize off of all of this attention that New Orleans will be getting, specifically mm-hmm. around Katrina. Mm-hmm. So what else are you, how else are you going to participate in? Do you have any ways in which you're commemorating or, you know, groups that you're working with? Or because I know that there needs to be, and there people are working on a counter narrative to mm-hmm. that of resiliency and recover and, you know, this blank slate that people got to come and paint all over.
Yeah. A couple ideas have been thrown at me, but nothing is concrete. So one organization that I'm involved with wanted to do a panel discussion around transplants and what it means to be a New Orleans native versus a transplant, specifically among activists and community organizers. But that's not concrete. People, all the people I know, they do things at the last minute. So ask me again in the beginning of August and I might have an answer. But also in relation to the film specifically, Edward and I are planning on doing like a story circle, but like public with an audience. So some of the Katrina babies who will be featured in the film gathering to discuss our various experiences together. Individually, I haven't yet come up with something that I feel will do it justice. I'm still trying to figure out what exactly my ritual will be to observe it. Yearly, I generally ignore it, honestly. I'm just like, oh, August 29th, okay. Mm-hmm. That one day. And the last couple of years, I wasn't here for it. I was living elsewhere, so it was easier to do. We'll see.
I think this year, yeah, it's gonna.
Yeah, it's gonna be hard to ignore. It's gonna be hard.
Be like the super gra or something ridiculous. I totally blanked. I hate when I do that.
It happens live on air, doesn't it? Then you just gotta scat.
That's what I was gonna ask you about next. Right then, you just gotta scat. So. Cut the commercial. So you're also, we didn't talk too much about this, the accompanying piece, or it's not accompanying, it was standalone, but now it's kind of in conjunction with.
Yeah.
So tell us more about that, the
anthology.
The anthology, yes.
So basically I've gathered about 15 emerging Black scholars, creative writers, visual artists, photographers, I think that educators, community organizers, those are the categories. And all of us are writing, or not writing, some are doing like photo essays, some are just doing images of their visual artwork, some are doing critical theory essays, personal narratives, there's poetry, all of it around what I call, and I'm working on explaining this better, but I call it like the dual experience of displacement. So displacement as African people in the diaspora who have that ancestral memory encoded in our DNA from the enslavement and forced migration of our predecessors. And then that lived experience of displacement due to Hurricane Katrina. So having both of those, how that shapes how we relate to space and home, both the physical place that is New Orleans, that was our home for at least 12 years of our life, because some of the contributors didn't come back after the storm, and some of them are older than me, so I don't know why I said 12. But anyway, so how it shapes our relationship to this space and the work that we're doing here, and in communities elsewhere, and how it shapes our idea of what home is supposed to be, and especially most of us having either just graduated from undergrad or from grad school, and being in a position where we're setting up our homes, not, you know, the permanent ones, but more permanent than they were earlier in life, and more ours. So as we're settling and becoming more self-sufficient, how our resourcefulness and our stability, and our ownership of space, our idea of owning space, is shaped by that experience. So yeah.
One thing that I was thinking about was what your visions might be for how Black communities protect themselves from white neglect, mm-hmm. or white and state neglect, because, you know, they're pretty hand in hand, and there are, when we say state, we know that there aren't just all white bodies mm-hmm. running the state, and how to resist white recovery, mm-hmm. white and state recovery, which actually is removal, and
well,
if you have, I'm assuming that I, another I assumption an on my part.
I have an answer. So when we talk about white-led recovery efforts, it always leads to this, or from in the conversations I've had, it's always led to this, you know, but Black people aren't doing it, so, you know, somebody had to, like, we should just be thankful. So I guess my answer would be, we, and I know this is lofty, and but I do think it's practical in steps, and I don't expect that it is something that'll be fully enacted in, like, by the 20th anniversary of Katrina, but creating, but manifesting a community, an organizational and a spiritual infrastructure within our own communities, that keep us accountable to one another, that allow us to, you know, keep track of each other, or just like know that everyone is safe. And that's something I'm working on a very small scale. Last month with all of the murders that happened, specifically murders of Black women, I began gathering some of my friends and talking about how we can create rideshare systems, or even just have people who are like on shift at night to, if somebody's at work, like texting when you leave and texting when you make it to your destination, or calling if that makes you feel safer, or like meeting up if we're in the same vicinity so we can travel together. So anyway, it's just like creating ways, systems that, so that we don't have to look to them for protection, mm-hmm. So that we don't have to look to their police force. I mean, like, that's a problem. Like, we shouldn't need to call them ever, mm-hmm. period. Like, I don't care what happens. We should have that in our own systems of accountability, mm-hmm. And retribution. But no, seriously, yeah. So yeah.
We laugh, but we're very serious.
Yeah, but and part of what comes with that is segregation.
Oh. See, you bring that up at 8:56. In case you missed it, Lydia Y. Nichols said segregation. So explain what you mean by that in a way, because some people still hold the idea that segregation itself was mm-hmm. the problem.
Well, as our dear ancestor Malcolm X so eloquently explained once, and this is a paraphrase, this is not a direct quote, but he talked about the misconception of integration, or of what integration mean and meant and what segregation meant. So integration, I feel, has largely been considered like, how can we get into their institutions, and not how can we become self-sustaining? How can we sustain our own institutions and govern them ourselves? Which has been the problem. That's what segregation really was. Like, mm-hmm. the institutions that affected us were still run by people who had white supremacist tendencies.
Hating their hearts.
So... Mm. That's what, so how can we become a sovereign people? Like, how can we take control of the things that affect us, of the judicial system, of the policing system? These are things that we need to be in control of, because white folks have their own healing to do, and they are not as far along on that road as some might believe them to be, regardless of how politically correct they are in public. Ultimately, like, they need to go and do that for themselves over there. And and you can be friends with whoever you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can hang out. But while we're going through these healing processes, I believe that there needs to, those are healing processes that need to be done internally amongst ourselves.
Mm. Well, thank you.
That was my evil laugh.
It's about 9 o'clock, so we're pretty much out of time. So another plug for the film, and then I was thinking, is there a way for any Katrina babies that might hear this broadcast,
yes,
and how they would connect with you?
Yes, yes to all of the above. So we have been talking about Katrina Babies, the documentary film directed by filmmaker Edward Buckles, also a Katrina baby like myself. We are doing a fundraising campaign. We are in the midst of a fundraising campaign right now. Indiegogo.com, search Katrina Babies. It should come up. And if you are a Katrina baby and would like to contact us and share your story with us, we would love to have you featured in the film. Our email address is katrinababies@gmail.com, katrinababies@gmail.com.
All right. So if you want to share your tale of your experience being a Katrina baby, please. You know,
please do. Yes,
it's an important project. These are stories that should be told by the people who experienced it. That's one thing I also wanted to hold up, is that this isn't outsiders doing this. These aren't even transplants. These are the Katrina babies telling the story of the Katrina baby. So thank you so much.
I would
love to have you back on to talk about maybe what you're doing for the Katrina 10 or as we get, as this project continues to develop. And please bring some others on with you.
Sure.
You're welcome anytime. Thank you so much, Lydia Y. Nichols.
Thank you.
All right. So we're just going to jump right on into the calendar. You're listening to WTUL New Orleans, 91.5 FM. It's 9 a.m. on Wednesday morning, so it's almost time for Democracy Now! But first, let's tell you what's going on around town. At the Howlin' Wolf at 8:30 p.m. in the Den, it's the Summer Jazz Series featuring Keith Anselmo Drum Clinic. Siberia, 6 p.m., Mistress Kali's Cabinet of Curiosities. 9 p.m., The Dreaming, Death Valley High, Death Church. Bank Street Bar, 10 p.m., Major Bacon. Checkpoint Charlie has T-Bone Stone and the Happy Monsters at 7 p.m., followed by Hubcap Kings at 11 p.m. Circle Bar has Venpacha's Flamenco Ensemble. I tried a little bit. I don't know. I'm sure I'm still doing it wrong. That's at 10 p.m. So Flamenco Ensemble, Circle Bar, 10 p.m. Gasa Gasa y los Dos Pistoles. See, I know Spanish. Blackfire and Danny. That's 9 p.m. at Gasa Gasa. Preservation Hall has the Preservation Hall All-Stars, 8, 9, and 10 p.m. Snug Harbor, it's the Uptown Jazz Orchestra with Delfeo Marsalis at 8 and then again at 10. Zeitgeist is showing Hungry Hearts, a young married couple in New York engage in a fateful struggle over the life of their newborn child. 7:30 p.m. that's playing. And the Yes Men are revolting. The environmental human rights corporate pranksters are at it again with a whole new set of exploits. And that is playing at 9:30 with the Zeitgeist. Okay, you're listening to WTUL New Orleans, 91.5 FM. It's